What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
It has been 710 days since October 7th, 2023. In today's casualties update, there have been 67,000 plus Palestinians murdered by Israel since October 7th. This includes over 200 journalists and 422 people murdered by starvation, including over 120 children. A statement from the ministry said 53 people have been murdered in the past 24 hours, with 16 more buildings flattened to the ground. We know from researchers outside of the Palestinian Health Ministry that the death toll is probably closer to 80,000, and even that is likely an undercount. Here on Law and Disorder, we spent the majority of the Mondays of the last almost 2 years bringing you Palestine Post, where we push back on the Israeli and U.S. mainstream media campaign of disinformation in their attempt to justify a genocide. We begin today's Palestine Post with headlines analysis with Phyllis Bennis, a Middle East analyst who directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's the author of several books, her latest being Understanding Palestine and Israel. Good morning, Phyllis.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
I'm glad that you're here. I am not glad that it is almost 2 years. I really woke up with that sitting heavy on me this morning, that we are less than a month away from 2 years. I mean, you've been doing this work for decades, and I imagine even for you, this has to be a bit mind-blowing, maybe?
This is really, really hard. There's no question these last 2 years have been devastatingly hard for anyone who has family or friends inside Palestine or Israel, but who in the region, across the region these days, where Israel has been assaulting all across the region, anyone who cares about justice, who cares about human rights, has been having a really bad couple of years. And, you know, I think that's something that those of us who have worked on it for a long time, you're right, we've never seen anything like this. We weren't around alive, or at least consciously alive. Most of us weren't alive at all at the time of the Nakba in 1947-48 to see the only thing that comes close to this. But this is already far worse than the Nakba of 1948. The one thing I would say, though, that I think is really important, Kat, is that this is also a moment when we are seeing a rise, a strengthening, a boldness of a movement that we never imagined before. A movement that is both the conscious Palestinian rights movement, which is stronger than ever and bigger than ever and clearer than ever, and an even broader and wider, maybe not as deep, but broad and wide and operating closer to positions of power than we ever imagined, who came out for the call, ceasefire now. And with that call, managed to maintain a kind of message discipline on the one hand, with everybody saying the call for ceasefire is primary, and at the same time, managing to redefine what ceasefire meant. So ceasefire also had to mean permanent ceasefire, not just immediate, but immediate and permanent. And it had to include unlimited access to massive amounts of humanitarian aid to deal with this crisis that has killed, as you say, now it's up to 425 people who have been killed from the Israeli-imposed famine, 145 of them children. And to say that we also need an arms embargo. We need to stop sending arms. And we have with us numbers that were unfathomable just a couple of years ago. 77% of Democrats say no more aid to Israel. 61% of all voters say that. That's like unimaginable, as I say. We never thought we could get there. The big problem is, and this is the same problem that we face trying to challenge the rise of authoritarianism, the rise of threats of fascism, we have a lack of strategy of how to go about challenging this gap between where the electeds are in, for example, the Democratic Party, who still seem to believe that criticizing Israel is political suicide somehow, and the base of their party, who are saying in more than three quarters of all Democratic voters saying no more aid to Israel. This is extraordinary. And that gap has never been wider. So that's one of the things on our agenda to change in all parties. It's not a partisan issue. It's more visible right now among the Democrats. But this is a problem all over, that people are changing way faster than the Democratic leadership, than the members of Congress as a whole. That's a huge challenge that we face right now.
A couple of threads I want to tug on there. Phyllis, I debated whether or not I was going to go here or not. However, howsoever, I spent my time in Hollywood, and what happened at the Emmys, I mean, that would have been career suicide. Like, it just, that would have been, it would have been over. Even I remember in 2005 when people were talking about Katrina, that was career suicide, right? To say anything on the stage. And yet last night you saw some pretty big heavy hitters saying free Palestine.
And you know, this is not only here. I'm also thinking about what happened at the Venice Film Festival, one of the most prestigious, most elite, most controlled of all of the major film festivals, right? I also grew up in LA with, you know, Hollywood's a company town.
Yeah.
And we saw this every year. There were protests at the Oscars for something or against something. But this time they showed the story of Hind Rajab, the 6-year-old child who was left in her car when all of the relatives in the car with her had been shot dead in the 300 bullets Israeli troops had fired at the car seeking to escape to what was supposed to be a, quote, safe zone. And she was the only one who survived. And she was on the phone with the
It's
first
okay.
responders. And the film that's been made, it's a feature film about that incident, but using the actual video, not video, but the actual audio tapes of her talking, screaming, desperate to the first responders who are trying to keep her alive. And there was a 25-minute standing ovation for that film. The first time in history there's been anything close to that. So that says something about where public opinion is all around the world, not only here, where people here are recognizing we are responsible. Our government is writing the checks to make this possible, to enable this genocide. This was the whole world on their feet to stand with the child. So it's an amazing moment on both sides. The challenge again is that all of these changes are medium and long term. When I wrote this new book, I was devastated at the prospect of doing it because it just seemed that no matter how good a book might be, no matter how useful it might be, it changes things in the medium and long term at best. And we don't have a medium or long term. We don't have the time because this is a genocide that is killing people, as you just reported in the weekly numbers. 37 killed so far this morning, just so far, 25 of them in Gaza City. The others included 6-year-old twins, a family of six that was wiped out. You know, this is what we're dealing with day to day, hour to hour. So the looking at the long-term changes are not going to be enough. So that's this challenge that we face between recognizing what our movement has made possible and how we're seeing it play out in Hollywood, somewhat in the media, nothing close to that, but massive changes underway in the mainstream media, as well as among our own alternative media, at an enormous price. The number of journalists killed in Gaza in less than 2 years just hit 250. That's more than all the journalists killed in World War I, World War II, Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq combined. More than that in this tiny strip of territory in less than 2 years. That's shocking to anyone's conscience. And that's what we're dealing with on a daily basis. So that's what we're looking at. You know, it was extraordinary on Thursday, the General Assembly at the United Nations took up the question of Palestine. And this was, you know, pretty amazing that they were talking with levels of outrage and demands for action that I had really never heard from countries, from major European countries to all the Arab countries, but not one of them was focused on the impact of the genocide on the people of Gaza. They were focused on the attack on Hamas the Hamas negotiators, who Israel targeted, didn't kill any of them, but killed six other people, in Qatar. And so the outrage was, how dare they do this in a sovereign state? How dare they violate the sovereignty of Qatar, which no doubt is a serious crime. There's no question about it. And Qatar is a clear, important ally of the United States, tiny little country the size of Connecticut. You can like drive across it in 2 hours. That encloses within it an enormous U.S. airbase, the biggest one in the region, in Qatar. So this was a hugely illegal attack, no doubt. But the level of sort of personal, passionate outrage that we had not seen when we were talking about people being killed on an hourly basis in Gaza was quite something. Today, the Arab and Muslim governments are meeting in Doha to talk about how to respond. There's lots of big talk already. There's going to be more, I think, throughout the day. But whether there's going to be any action, are they going to do anything to make an arms embargo real, to make sure that they are not allowing any either financial or political or diplomatic or any other kind of support to the transfer of fuel, whether it's coal or oil or anything else, to Israel, that would allow the enabling of the genocide to continue? Are we going to hear any of those things? Are we going to hear about sanctions? Are we going to hear about dissolving the so-called Abraham Accords and saying, no, we do not normalize relations diplomatically with a country that is violating the laws against genocide, that we won't do that anymore? I don't think we're going to be hearing that.
And to help illustrate that point a little bit, Phyllis, I think for my listeners, it might make sense to talk about the relationship between the United Arab Emirates and the United States. You mentioned the U.S. airbase being in Qatar. There's U.S. airbases across Gulf states. So there is this economic relationship that's valuable to those of, you know, to the United States government. So can there be any real response unless the United States says there can be a real response?
Well, the United States has a veto in the Security Council where it can just stop things right off. But there are things, for example, again, at the United Nations that the General Assembly can do and in fact has done. The General Assembly, where there is no veto and is by far the most democratic part of the United Nations, one country, one vote, no vetoes, they have passed under the much touted Uniting for Peace precedent, they have passed an extraordinary resolution last summer, almost exactly a year ago. It'll be a year on Thursday. It will be 1 year, in which they called for sanctions, they called for an arms embargo, they called for a host of pressure to be brought to bear against Israel with the goal of stopping the genocide, called on Israel to abide by all of the rulings, the preliminary rulings of the International Court of Justice, called on Israel to abide by the advisory opinion of the ICJ that ruled that the entire Israeli colonial framework is completely illegal and that they need to remove all of the settlers. They used the word evacuate. The court used the word evacuate the settlers immediately. The General Assembly thought, well, immediately is maybe a little unrealistic. Let's give them 1 year. So by Thursday, we can look at the occupied West Bank and occupied Gaza Strip and occupied East Jerusalem, and we won't see any settlers, right? Because Israel is going to abide by this ruling. Well, no, that's not going to happen. But it was an extraordinary move. When you see this, when you ask, you know, what can they do if the U.S. is against it? There is plenty they could do. The Gulf states, number one, could stop buying arms from the United States. That's number one. Impose their own arms embargo. They don't need the UN to tell them to do that. They can do that unilaterally, every one of them. The Gulf states collectively have a $4 trillion in their sovereign wealth funds, these nationally held massive funds that they invest all around the world. Well, let's look at those investments. What are they investing in that is directly or more likely indirectly enabling the Israeli occupation, the Israeli genocide, the Israeli apartheid? Are they, for example, investing in shipping companies whose ships are transiting the oceans carrying coal or carrying other fuel, carrying oil or carrying weapons to Israel? There's lots of things they could do without the U.S. having any say in the matter. Now, will the U.S. simply stand by and allow them to do that? Of course not. We will be hearing from the United States. That is a very real risk, and governments take that risk. But if the world is united and only the United States stands with the genocide Israel is carrying out, stands with it and enables it, arms it, pays for it. Don't forget, last year we paid 40% of Israel's entire military budget. You don't do that for anybody. With all of that, if the whole world is ostensibly united, the world could stand together and tell the U.S., you know, we know you're going to threaten us. We know that there will be tariffs, there will be fines, there will be all kinds of punishments. And you know what? The rest of the world can manage because we will stand together to say, no, genocide is not okay, even when it's being carried out by the most powerful country in the world and its junior ally and partner in the region.
I don't, I'm watching clock tick and I also have so much I want to talk to you about. I don't want to lose sight of the fact that the same week that Israel bombed Doha, it also bombed Lebanon. It also bombed the family boat in the Samud flotilla fleet. It also bombed a missing
In Tunis. There were
yes.
seven countries.
Yeah, they bombed, thank you. They bombed seven countries in 1 week. I mean, even for Israel, that's
Oh, no,
sort of
sorry.
like
Six. They didn't bomb Iran directly in that week. That was a month ago. So it was six. But it's been seven
Syria.
countries in this last 2 years.
What from your perspective, from your perch, because you've got a way broader perspective view than I do. What happened? And even for them, that's a lot.
This is an effort by Israel to assure the rest of the region and indeed the world that they remain the regional hegemon, that they can rely, in their view, on U.S. support regardless of what they do, regardless of whether President Trump or Secretary of State Rubio or the Defense Secretary or anybody else, members of Congress, stand by and say, well, we're not really happy you did this. You know, it was fine that you attacked the Hamas negotiators. We're fine with that. But you really shouldn't have done it in Qatar because they're really close friends also. That's essentially what the U.S. said about the Qatar bombing. The other bombings, the U.S. basically is fine with it, says nothing about it. But what this says is that Israel has the understanding, and they're right. They are not wrong about this. They have impunity because Washington grants them impunity. For all of the talk about, you know, we wish they were not killing so many Palestinians. Maybe we will hold back on sending the 5,000-pound bunker buster bombs that Israel was using on neighborhoods in Gaza, where one bomb can destroy an entire city block and every living thing on it, people, animals, trees, everything. They held it for a few weeks and then released it all. And of course, during that 3 weeks that they were holding it back, the Israeli arsenal already had over 1,000 of those giant bombs. So nobody was bothered too much. And for all the people who kept saying, how is it that Netanyahu feels like he can just stand up to Trump like this, that he can ignore what he says? Well, he can ignore it because of what Trump does, whatever his language. This was exactly the same with Biden. He talked more about how unhappy he was, how heartbroken he was at the casualties, and did nothing, nothing to stop it. On the day that there was one of the horrific bombings in Gaza in that first year, when seven humanitarian aid workers from the World Central Kitchen were targeted in a, they were in three cars. They were targeted deliberately, first car, second car, third car. Seven of them were killed. Of that group, unusually, only one was Palestinian. The others were all Europeans, North Americans, and Australians. They were white, which I think is not irrelevant. Because it was after that that President Biden said, I'm heartbroken. Maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. He's a sentimental guy, could well be. But 8 hours later, that same day, his administration signed off on a new, I forget the amount of that one. I think it was maybe the $12 billion one. It was one of the big arms deals that was shipping more arms to Israel. So really, we're supposed to care that he's brokenhearted, whether it's true or not? His actions show his priorities. And his actions say Israel can kill whoever it wants, wherever they might be, whoever they are. We sort of regret it if they're white and if they're American, but we're not going to do anything to stop that either. That is what we are dealing with here. They are right to count on it. Whether anyone in particular knew about the Israeli strike on Qatar, whether Trump knew about it ahead of time, whether the Pentagon knew about it and gave the green light, whether Trump directly gave the green light, we don't know those details yet. But it also doesn't matter. Because with the weapons that are provided to Israel with no conditions, we made it possible. So we are complicit. Whether or not anybody knew about the specifics of it or not, that's really pretty irrelevant. We enabled it. We made it possible. We paid for it. We provided the arms. That makes us responsible for that action.
Lastly, Phyllis, before I let you go, also on Friday, the United Nations voted to officially move forward with a two-state solution. I mean, I don't mean to laugh. It's not funny. It is, however, absurd at this point. Like, to me, this is an absurd conversation to be having right now.
Right. It is. I think there's a significance that's similar to this question of all the countries that are now coming out and saying we are going to vote, and they're probably going to do this on Thursday and Friday. It's a very big deal. We're going to vote to recognize the state of Palestine. Full diplomatic relations. Yay. And, you know, my reaction when I met with one of the ambassadors from one of those countries a few weeks ago, and when she said that and assumed I was going to be quite thrilled, I said, well, that's great. You'll be number 148. And what exactly do you think is going to change? Because what it means is the people of Gaza will be facing apartheid, occupation, colonialism, and genocide in an occupied state instead of an occupied territory. Are they going to be any less dead? Are the bombs going to kill fewer children because they are in a state and not a territory? It changes nothing. The significance is because of something else. The significance is both for the recognition and for this renewed focus on the two-state solution is only happening because these governments are under such pressure in their own countries. And that gives me a little bit of hope, because this is the model we can look back to. We know it works. From the 1980s in the anti-apartheid movement against apartheid South Africa, when similarly, resolution after resolution would go to the Security Council, the U.S. would keep vetoing, vetoing, vetoing. Then it would go to the General Assembly, and they would pass these resolutions with enormous majorities. And the U.S. would say, well, we don't care because General Assembly resolutions are not binding, right? But then what happened was activists all over the world, across Europe, across Asia, much of Latin America, and almost all of Africa, took those resolutions with their list of sanctions that were supposed to be imposed and started demanding it of their own countries. One after another started imposing real sanctions, sports sanctions, banking sanctions, trade sanctions, certainly arms embargoes, all those things, the arms embargo being the most important one. And right now, that means not buying arms or military surveillance equipment, for instance, from Israel, because they produce some of the best in the world. So those kinds of campaigns led to eventually the U.S. being so isolated that the government, the Congress, the White House, the Reagan administration finally had to allow the U.S. to impose sanctions on apartheid South Africa. And that set the stage for what the South African people were doing on their own in their own country to end it. That's what was so extraordinary. And that's what we can do again. The challenge is how fast can we do that? How fast can we move? And that's why these urgent meetings at the UN are being matched by side events carried out by activists and civil society groups, the Gaza Tribunal, the Hague Group, and others, to remind people of what really has to happen. That it's not enough to keep talking about how many countries recognize the state of Palestine, how much are we really committed to an illusory two-state solution. That doesn't matter. But these calls for sanctions, especially the arms sanctions, and continuing the struggle for accountability, that those are the things that we can actually do.
Well, Phyllis Bennis, it's too long since I had you on the show. Really glad to have you back. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.